You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and we're really pleased to have with me once again Lynn Alden. She's certainly become very well known in the financial world. A lot of people paying a lot of attention to her, and for good reason, because she really puts her skill set as an engineer and applies the same kind of critical, logical thinking to finance. And so her work is greatly appreciated by yours truly, and really pleased to have her with me again. It's Lynn Alden, LynAlden.com. Go there. There's a lot of free things, but she does have a very reasonably priced paid service as well for investors that I highly recommend, and I have taken advantage of myself. So thanks for joining me again, Lynn. It's really a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me again. Happy to be here.
Oh, it's really good to have you. And you really do a great job. This article that I wrote, it's about, oh gosh, I guess it's about 50-some pages or so, almost 60 pages or so, called The Fraying of the U.S. Global Currency Reserve System. You know, as you point out in your article, a lot of people have been saying for some time, have been harping or, you know, making sort of shallow claims about the dollar. The dollar's days are over. They're ending. The dollar is toast. You know, I think I've probably been guilty of saying that sometimes myself as a gold bug. But you point out in your article that there are some issues. I mean, there are really some built-in, you know, systems break down in the dollar, the financial system, the monetary system based on the petrodollar is certainly not perfect. It has a lot of flaws and it's fraying, as you point out. But I'd like to start out by just asking you to explain, you know, how is the dollar referred to as the petrodollar?
Sure. So ever since the Bretton Woods system ended in 1971, currencies have been on a free floating exchange rate. And so basically that, you know, back then, the dollar is backed by gold and then other currencies were pegged to the dollar. But when that system broke down, you know, these currencies all became fiat currencies. And then, you know, policymakers had a tough problem on their hands because, you know, there's dollar devaluation, there's, you know, widespread currency devaluation against gold. The United States had energy crises, and so one of the deals they made, which was that Saudi Arabia would sell their oil only in dollars. So no matter what country is buying from them, you know, if France buys oil from Saudi Arabia, even though it's neither of their currencies, they pay in the dollar. And then Saudi Arabia would reinvest a lot of those dollars into buying U.S. treasuries. In exchange for that, the U.S. can provide protection and various military deals and other sort of lucrative trade. And that extended to you know, most of OPEC. And so we've been in this nearly 50-year period where virtually all oil and most other commodities are priced in dollars globally. And that creates a situation where there's this artificial demand for the dollar because every country needs dollars in order to, procure energy and other commodities. And it was originally described as an exorbitant privilege, right? Because mm-hmm. the United States could print money and basically buy commodities in its own currency, and it was the only country that really could do that. But that also opened up problems. And so if you look at, say, the U.S. trade deficit over the very long term, it completely blew out right after the petrodollar system was created, right after Bretton Woods system ended. Mm-hmm. And so because basically there's so much demand for the dollar, and so that makes it so that our imports, you know, we have a lot of importing power, but it makes our exporting competitiveness pretty weak. Mm-hmm. And it makes it so that the entire global system is really dependent on one country's currency. And then what's increasingly happening now is that in addition to all these trade deficits really messing up the United States' domestic economy, we also have the fact that, you know, when this system was developed nearly 50 years ago, the United States was something like 35% of world GDP. And that's declined over time because, of course, we've had the rise of China, we've had the rise of various emerging markets. And now the United States is something like 20% of global GDP, but our currency is still, you know, pretty much the only currency used for global energy pricing. And so it's basically squeezing the rest of the world. And so we're starting to see alternative payment systems, right? Where so Russia has really spearheaded this, where they are increasingly selling their oil to Europe and to China in euros.
Right. Russia is doing that. And of course, not making the United States very happy about that. But I'd like to ask you, why do you think Saudi Arabia would make this deal with the U.S.? Was there some sort of an exchange where the U.S. would ensure the ruling elite there, the royal family, perhaps? Or why did Saudi Arabia agree to do that, I wonder, with the U.S.?
Yeah, mainly that. It just established them in the region, and it gave them increased legitimacy and defense. And it also made it so that, you know, they could more easily ship oil around the world because they basically have the U.S. military backing their all the supply lines.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the U.S. military has been a part of this program as well, then, I guess, right? And I think you point out in the article, Saddam Hussein decided he wanted to get paid in euros and didn't want to just take dollars. That didn't end too well for him. I think maybe the same thing might have happened in Libya to Gaddafi. So the U.S. is sort of used its strong military presence around the world to keep open the sea lanes and to ensure that the dollar was continued to be used as a reserve currency. So that meant that we could then do what? We could create endless amounts of money to finance the empire, to expand the empire, to do what? I mean, I'm much older than you, Lynn, and I remember was a young man during Vietnam. And I remember when we went off the gold standard, a young man reading about it in the New York Times on 16th of August, 1971, and thinking, why in the world would other countries accept this? And at that time, the United States, was engaging in Vietnam, the war, and Lyndon Johnson had his Great Society program. All of that was going to cost a lot of money. And how do we pay for it? Well, the politicians weren't going to tax us, tell Americans they were going to have to raise their taxes to fight a war on the other side of the world. It wasn't going to tell us we had to raise our taxes to engage in socialism, which was something, especially back in those days, it was a no-no. I guess it was so that we could just expand. I mean, who benefited from this, I guess, is what I'm getting at. People closest to government, perhaps, the people that had contracts with the military. Why did the United States feel like we had to, to become this great empire?
Yeah, the overall system was really beneficial, mainly to people towards the top of the income ladder or the political ladder. And so it was beneficial to government. It was beneficial to major corporations, globalization, all of that. And the primary, people that really suffered from it were, parts of the middle class, especially people that work in manufacturing and other sort of, kind of hard asset type of work. And so basically, in order to make sure that there's a lot of dollars out in the world, the United States basically runs these really persistent trade deficits ever since the mid-70s. And so basically, we've outsourced a lot of our supply chains to China, to Europe, to Japan. And so it's not just a developed market to emerging market phenomenon, because many other developed markets like Japan and Germany have not experienced this to the same degree that the United States has. It's really been highly tied to our petrodollar system. And back then, we were in Cold War, and so I've seen some analysts make the argument that say back then it could have made more sense because it increased, basically we sacrificed some degree of domestic vibrancy for basically what you can refer to as an empire. We basically extended our hegemonic reach. Mm-hmm. And so that had various trade-offs back then. It had some pros, it had some cons, depending on what side of that equation you were on. But now it's at the point where it's not even really serving the hegemonic benefits anymore, and some of those downsides have gotten really big. And one thing I point out in the article is that China, for example, has been using the petrodollar system against us as well. So in addition to some of these countries beginning to go around the system and use non-dollar payment systems for energy, some of them have also been really benefiting with mercantilist policies from this, the way the system's currently structured. And so it's really not even benefiting the U.S. anymore, let alone, the U.S. middle class that it's been hurting for a while.
Right. The U.S. middle class has been hurting for a while. Coming from Ohio, where I come from, my father was a machinist in around Canton, Ohio, the northeastern part of Ohio. I remember in the 60s and the 50s, especially as a young kid, how we were very optimistic about things in that part of the world, that the St. Lawrence Seaway had just been developed, and well, we were going to be almost like a coastal region of the country. But then things changed as with this monetary system, and the Rust Belt, or the middle America, the people that actually produce things, I like to say the miners, the manufacturers, the farmers, the inventors, maybe the farmers not as much, but people that actually do things seem to have gotten hurt very badly. And I would suggest that that's one of the reasons that Donald Trump was elected, was this idea that maybe somehow that part of the country could be brought back again. But it doesn't seem to be. It doesn't seem to be happening as long as... Well, here's the thing. I want to ask you about Robert Triffin. If you could explain to our listeners a little bit about Triffin's dilemma, and because you talk about the atrophy that's built into this petrodollar system. Maybe just talk a little bit about that, if you would, Lynn.
Yeah, so Robert Triffin was an economist. And so back when the Bretton Woods system was constructed, there were some economists, including him from the beginning, that said the system would ultimately fail. And basically, what he pointed out is that that the United States would run capital count issues, and so basically, what would happen is that the United States only had so much gold; they had a tremendous amount of gold, but the amount of liabilities on that gold, because dollar was convertible to gold for foreigners, and so as the foreign official sector had more and more dollars, they redeemed those for gold. And eventually, our gold reserves are no longer enough to satisfy our liabilities, especially because, as you pointed out, in the late 60s and early 70s, they were engaging in pretty big deficits for wars and for domestic programs. And so that made the gold standard really hard to maintain. And eventually, basically, the foreign sector called the bluff on it, and Nixon had to basically end that system because it was no longer mathematically sustainable. Now, since that system ended, the Triffin's dilemma has been reapplied to the petrodollar system, and it's basically in this version, it goes that in order to supply dollars around the world for all of this energy pricing, there's only a couple ways to do it, and the easiest way that it works is that the U.S. ends up running really big trade deficits, and so the same kind of flaw that brought down the Bretton Woods system. Is you basically manifest again in a slightly different way in the petrodollar system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems to me this notion that you have to have this enormous export deficit, that you have to run these deficits, trade deficits, that, in order to keep enough liquidity out there to keep the dollar out there, so that it can be the world's reserve currency. It seemed to me when the United States was leading the way with so-called free trade that we were basically cutting our tariffs more than other countries were required to cut theirs. And it seems to me that may have been a policy measure in order to retain this system. But I'm not sure if that was intentional or not, but it seems to be what happened. And again, I think Donald Trump might have been a reaction to that. So Triffin really sort of saw, or at least as you say, it's being applied now to the petrodollar system. I'd like to ask you, how then is China using, you mentioned that China is now using the petrodollar system against the United States. Maybe you could explain that.
Yeah, sure. So basically the downside of the petrodollar system for the U.S., as you mentioned, is those persistent trade deficits. Now, some of the upside for it, while it works, is that foreigners finance part of the U.S. government deficits, which can feel really good while it's happening, and it's been happening, and it's been happening for decades. So, an entire generation or two has really benefited from that. In the beginning, our major trade partner was Europe. So, Europe would run really big, trade surpluses with us. They'd get a lot of dollars, and then they'd reinvest a lot of those dollars into holding U.S. treasuries as their foreign exchange reserves. And so they would basically cycle those dollars back into financing our government deficits. Then with the rise of Japan, you know, that center of you know, dollar flow kind of shifted over, and so Japan ran really big trade surpluses with us, and again they cycled those dollars back into buying treasuries. Then roughly, you know, about 20 years ago, we started to see the sharp rise of China, and so they became the ones that ran the biggest trade surpluses with us. And again, they cycled their dollars back into buying treasuries, and they eventually accumulated over $1 trillion worth of treasuries. But then in 2013, China said it's really no longer in our best interest to keep buying treasuries, and so we're not going to do that anymore. And then instead, they announced the Belt and Road Initiative, which is basically that they started making dollar loans to developing countries around the world to develop infrastructure or to secure commodity rights. You know, mm-hmm. because China is, of course, a very large commodity importer. And is now the biggest commodity importer. And so they are still running very large trade surpluses with the United States, but then they're taking those dollars and then they're basically securing all their own commodity rights and basically buying hard assets around the world rather than recycling those dollars back into buying treasuries. And that's, of course, you know, over time led to you know, more and more kind of geopolitical conflicts between the United States and China. And it basically, you know, no one cared as much about the trade deficit many years ago when China was, you know, putting a lot of that money back into U.S. deficits and mm-hmm. treasuries. But now, of course, we care a lot more because China is no longer cycling those dollars back into treasuries and they're doing their own thing. And so the United States is really on the short end of the stick here, you know, ironically, with the system that they constructed all these decades ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so we've depended on the kindness of strangers, as some people has put it in the past, to buy our treasuries, you know, recycling those export dollars, those export earnings into the U.S. treasuries. And now nobody wants treasuries. I can't blame them. They're paying nothing. They're paying less than nothing, in real terms, at least. And, you know, we're still dependent on foreigners, except now the central bank has to step in and start to buy our treasuries because no one else wants them, right? I mean, there's some pension funds and the like that have to buy some. But for the most part, it doesn't make a lot of sense to go buy treasuries now. And so people are buying stuff. They're buying tangibles, I think, more investors.
Yeah, exactly. There's still some demand for treasuries. It's you know, some institutions have to use it for collateral. And if you look at Japanese investors, for example, they pay close attention to FX hedged treasury yields compared to you know, their own government bond yields. And so there's kind of this demand around the margin, but it's just not enough demand to keep up with the massive amount of new supply. And so foreign holdings of treasuries have been relatively flat over the past year, even though U.S. supply of those treasuries has ballooned by trillions of dollars. And so the Federal Reserve has become the largest buyer. And now actually, the Federal Reserve holds more treasuries than all foreign central banks combined.
Wow.
And so that basically is, I've used the analogy, like we're a restaurant that, you know, where the cook is eating her own cooking more than her customers are.
Not a good situation. And China, on the other hand, I mean, we owe all this money to other countries yet, other countries that are holding treasuries. And China, though, isn't in the same position. I think they are not beholden to other countries so much, right? If anything,
yeah,
they're...
Yeah, so they are a net creditor nation, meaning
exactly,
they own...
Exactly, as
they
we were at one point.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and so just with a couple of minutes left here yet, Lynn, I would like to just mention to Alistair McLeod's article, "The Next Dollar Problem Has Just Arrived." I don't know if you happen to read Alistair or if you follow his work at all, but he's pointing out that in the last 2 weeks we've seen M1 increase by 14%. That's not 14% per annum, that's 14% in 2 weeks, and he's pointing out that that has come at the expense of M2, which he says is largely because banks aren't lending money now. Banks are afraid to lend money. The economy is not reviving as they had expected it would shortly after COVID sprung up. And Alistair is really concerned that we could see a disintegration of the dollar fairly quickly. I don't know to what extent, with a minute left, you might share those concerns or not.
I think it's something to watch. I mean, as you correctly pointed out, that was mostly a shift from M2 to M1, and so uh-huh. You know, it's basically you know, instead of savings accounts, it's been in demand deposits like checking accounts, and so it's something to watch. Ironically, in the near term, that can potentially strengthen the dollar because if banks are not lending dollars, then it's harder to get dollars. And as we've talked about in previous discussions, the foreign sector has a lot of dollar-denominated debt as well as dollar-denominated assets. And so whenever the dollar gets really tight, sometimes you get this mad rush into dollars as a safe haven. So in the near term, that could ironically potentially give it a little increase. And in fact, in the last couple of days, we have seen a little bit of a bounce in the dollar index. And so I'm mostly focusing on the long term rather than, you know, what might happen over a 3 to 6 month period.
Well, there was so much more I wanted to ask you about. I'm sorry we don't have time. Certainly, I know you're gold. You're into Bitcoin. You do put out a newsletter, and people can learn to know, a very reasonably priced newsletter as well, and people can learn to know what you're doing and what you're advising your clients to do. So I want to thank you so much, Lynn, for being with us. Always a pleasure. It's always enlightening and very helpful for our listeners. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week. Next week, Charles Hugh Smith will be my main guest, and we'll also be talking to Jim Gregg of Benchmark Metals. So until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.